It's Central Time. I'm Rob Farah.
And I'm Veronica Rickard. Coming up on Central Time, immigration has been a big topic in the presidential election. We'll hear the story of a woman whose parents crossed the border when she was a child.
First, following the shooting at a peaceful protest in Dallas, Texas last week that resulted in the death of five police officers, lawmakers around the country have started to introduce bills that would further protect law enforcement.
Louisiana was the first state in the nation to introduce Blue Lives Matter legislation in May, which treats attacks on law enforcement as a hate crime.
Other states have followed suit, especially following the aftermath of Dallas. One of those states is Wisconsin, where a lawmaker announced a Blue Lives Matter bill yesterday.
If the bill is passed, it would extend the same protected status to law enforcement officials that aim to protect marginalized groups, such as racial and religious minorities.
Joining us now to talk about the law is David Steffen. He's the Republican representative from Howard in Wisconsin's 4th Assembly District. He authored the bill. Representative Steffen, welcome to Central Time.
Oh, good afternoon. Thank you for having me.
As I understand it, Representative Steffen, you had this in mind before the horrible events in Dallas. Can you talk us through your thinking, the history a little bit of what led you to unveil this legislation?
Absolutely. About a month and a half ago, two different law enforcement officials from two different communities in the area, they actually saw me at a diner, and they came up and sat down at my table and said, can we tell you about something that passed in Louisiana, and we'd love for you to introduce it here in Wisconsin? And so I began the process of researching and understanding and drafting the bill, and it actually landed back on my desk, back from the drafters, the morning after the Thursday shootings. And, you know, based on the situation and my personal views and thoughts on what we should be doing to supporting our law enforcement, I thought it was a appropriate time to release it to the public at that time to start generating awareness and support for the legislation so that in January I'd have a much better chance of becoming law.
Well, can you talk us through what would change under this new legislation?
So, as you mentioned in your opening, there are several groups, classes that are in this protected class and are therefore eligible for escalators with punishments when considered a hate crime. So, if a crime is specifically targeted against a religious group simply because of that religious designation, there are additional penalties and imprisonment times that can be associated, similar with race, similar with disability. Now with law enforcement, if this bill becomes law, is that attack against the badge, specifically because they wear the badge, will make a district attorney and judge provide them an opportunity to add on an additional hate crime punishment, which is up to 5 years in the case of a felony, but it also has some additional fines that would be applicable even down to some of the misdemeanors.
And specifically, would it have to be an act of violence against a police officer?
It does not. It actually can be a crime that is still considered a hate crime, even down to a misdemeanor level. So it does not need to be violence. Now, let's be clear here. We've had this on the books for many years in our state for the other protected classes. It, to my understanding, it's been used very rarely and only in very specific circumstances. That would be the same situation here. It would not change the daily operation of police going forward, but what it would do is provide district attorneys and judges in the state with an opportunity that if it is determined that there was some sort of crime that was specific to the badge, specific to someone being in uniform, they would have an opportunity for some additional fines, some additional penalties.
Talking to Republican Representative Assembly Representative David Steffen about his Blue Lives Matter legislation attaching hate crimes riders to charges for people targeting police officers. What have you heard from your colleagues in the legislature since you unveiled this yesterday?
Well, it's been overwhelmingly positive. The amount of support that has come out, I believe Governor Walker has also indicated his support for the bill. When I introduced it yesterday, there was approximately 100 law enforcement officers from around the state. Some drove as long as 2.5-3 hours to come to the press conference and be there and show their support. So I'm expecting wide bipartisan support on this bill once it is formally introduced in January.
Are you hopeful that this would actually deter acts, especially acts of violence targeting police officers?
Well, that is ultimately the hope. I mean, if it's kind of added after the fact, boy, you know, it has some benefit that there's justice still being done. But I'm very hopeful that whether it's a radical on the right or a radical on the left, that this will provide a deterrent to them to understand that if you decide to do some sort of action that is directed specifically at the badge because they wear the badge, that they will understand that there are exceptional penalties that will be applied in addition to the original charge.
Some people have raised a concern that because this isn't just about acts of violence, it could be, you mentioned, a misdemeanor. What about a protester protesting police as government employees and the actions that they take, or whether you agree with the protests or not? Is there a concern that this could deter First Amendment expression directed against government officials ultimately?
Well, I certainly hope that that's not, you know, the prevailing thought on it. I mean, here's some of the thoughts on this, is that we need to, especially in light of the situation we had, is provide adequate and appropriate protection for law enforcement. And this is one step in that direction. Now, you brought up a good thought, something to be considering. One of the great things about introducing this now, kind of in our off season, is it provides me 5 months to field input from individuals, groups, some legislators. I spoke with the leader of the NAACP from the area today, and I'm trying to put together a variety of different thoughts on it so I can make this a better bill. So this is a draft. It is just that, and we have 5 months to make this a better bill. And if those are concerns that need to be addressed, I am more than willing to look at that because, again, we have a lot of time before this will actually be introduced in a formal fashion in January.
People, since the law in Louisiana has passed, people said, you know, there are laws in place in many communities and many states that make it illegal to interfere with a police officer in the line of duty, things like that. Do we already have some laws in place that are maybe accomplishing what this new law would do?
So there are 37 states that have some sort of additional penalty involving with law enforcement. We would be the second to Louisiana to make it a hate crime. And so that is a special designation. And are there too many laws on the books in general? Well, I guess that's up for debate, and I wouldn't always disagree with you on that. But here's something to remember, is that last Thursday was the largest single-day loss of life in the United States law enforcement community since 9/11. And they deserve our support, they deserve our appreciation, and above all, they deserve our protection. And so this is one more step in that direction. And so I'm hopeful that the public, my colleagues down in Madison, will understand that that is the approach, that is the desired goal. And again, I'm open to ideas on how to improve upon the bill, but I'm very confident that one way or another, this bill will become law next year.
And as you mentioned, this would be officially introduced in January. I understand in Louisiana there was bipartisan support for their law there. Are you expecting that here in Wisconsin?
I am. I'm very hopeful. Certainly, I tell you what, it's the political season, so it's kind of the funny season here. And so I think people like to take positions, perhaps just maybe so that they can speak to a certain constituency. But at the end of the day, I think my colleagues, especially on the other side of the aisle, know that I am someone who is very open to ideas, always looking to collaborate. I think every one of my bills last session received wide bipartisan support. So I think I'm known in the Capitol as someone who's always willing and able and actually does reach across the aisle to get things done. And I'm expecting that we'll continue with this bill.
Representative Steffen, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you so much for having me.
That's David Steffen. He represents Wisconsin's 4th District in the State Assembly. He joined us today to talk about his newly unveiled Blue Lives Matter bill. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickard. Coming up, our guest psychologist tells us how the concept of honor has shaped America from bar fights to international policy.
Now, immigration is playing a big role in the upcoming presidential election. The issue's been in the news, of course, for a long time. Last month, the Supreme Court announced it was deadlocked in a case concerning President Obama's executive actions on immigration, which impact more than 4 million undocumented immigrants.
Our next guest has a personal perspective on immigration. She came to the United States from Mexico as an undocumented immigrant when she was going on 10 years old. Award-winning author Reina Grande joins us now. She's in the studio with us. Her latest book is called The Distance Between Us, and she's speaking tonight in Wisconsin. Reina, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you so much.
Well, your latest book, it's a memoir about your experience illegally immigrating from Mexico to the United States. Now, initially, your parents left first.
Yes,
and
that's
then
right.
You followed. But tell us a little bit about that story, what that was like. It's not necessarily a childhood everyone has.
No, it's not. But it's a story that thousands of youth here in the U.S. share. There are many immigrant youth in the country right now. And I think for me, one of the reasons why I wrote The Distance Between Us was to show people what it's like to be a child immigrant. And in the book, I write about my experiences before coming to the U.S. because I do believe that that's part of the conversation of being an immigrant, is why we come and what happens to us even before setting foot in this country. So in the book, I start with my mother leaving, and my father left when I was 2, so I didn't remember him. And to me, like in my earliest memories, he was already an absent father. But I started the book when my mother leaves, because that's really what impacted me the most, was to have to say to my mother, who was going to a country where most parents never come back from. And it was a really scary experience for me to not know if I would ever see her again. So the book opens with my mother's departure. And then I write about me and my siblings being left behind for several years under the care of my grandmother. And I try to capture the experience of those who stay behind, because I feel like sometimes when we're talking about immigration, we talk about immigrants once they're here and what they go through. But, you know, there's the story of what happens to those who are left behind. And children have that experience the most. And so I wanted to write from a child's perspective and to really show how immigration impacts the entire family, not just the ones who come, but also the ones who get left behind, and how that separation can have some really, you know, deep consequences in a family. And for me, like, you know, once I write about that experience of separation, and then when my family was reunited and I came to the country to be reunited with my parents, our relationship was never the same after that.
Well, so much to talk about there, but I want to pick up on something you said a little earlier. You said you wanted people to know why people came in the first place, what the conditions were like and what the factors were that's a big move to separate parents and children. And yet there are factors there that drove your family and thousands of others to do that. So what was it for you?
Well, my family, the cause for immigration was extreme poverty. We are from the state of Guerrero in Mexico, which is the second poorest state in Mexico, and 70% of the population lives in poverty. And my father was a bricklayer, and there were no jobs, so he didn't really have a way to take care of us and feed the family. And he also had a dream of being able to build us a brick house. And, you know, we lived in a little shack made of sticks and cardboard with no running water and no electricity. So he set out to the U.S. with the dream of being able to make enough money so that he could build us a house in Mexico. And he wasn't planning on staying here. I think most immigrants don't plan on staying. They come with the dream of making money so they could go back home and make something of themselves. But, you know, things change, and the economy in Mexico did not get any better. It got worse, and the country was in a recession, and the peso continued to be devalued. So then instead of being able to go back, my father was not able to, and he ended up sending for my mother so that she could come and help him work. And then eventually he went back and brought us here. And at the time, my father was undocumented, so the only way to bring us across was to smuggle us across the border. But that's the reason why we came. It was escaping the poverty and the lack of opportunities in my country. But, you know, there's so many other reasons why people migrate. But in the end, migration is forced on people. Most of the time, they do it because they have to. It's an act of survival. And, yeah, that you know, they might be escaping poverty, but they might be escaping violence and war and climate change and so many other things that go into play. But it's important to always ask ourselves, you know, what are we doing that's causing people to have to leave everything behind to go and try to survive elsewhere.
We're talking with Reina Grande right now. She's an award-winning author. Her latest book is called The Distance Between Us, and she's speaking tonight in Dane County at Centro Hispano. And Reina, you said your relationship with your parents, once you had that period of separation when they came over to the United States and you were behind in Mexico with your siblings, that things were never the same, even when they were reunited. And that's a big part of what your book is about, what that period of separation is like, what it does to families. So what was it like? Well, when you were waiting and you were in this long period of just not knowing what was going to happen.
Yeah, and the distance between us, that's why I called it the distance between us, because there's so many distances that I talk about. And the first one, of course, is the physical distance, you know, that they were 2,000 miles away from me. And for me, it was very hard to be separated from my parents because, you know, as a child, you don't understand that they left because there were no jobs, because of the money, because of the lack of opportunities. What I understood as a child was that my parents had left because they hadn't loved me enough to stay with me. And that really impacted my self-esteem, you know, and how I saw myself, that I felt I was not loved enough. And it took me a long time to realize that it was because they loved me too much. And that's why they had left. So it impacted my self-esteem. And also there was a lot of fear. Like I was afraid that they would never come back because they would forget about me. I was afraid that something might happen to them while they were working here that would prevent them to come back. Or I was afraid of being replaced by American-born children. And sure enough, a few months after my mother got here, she called us and said she was going to have a baby. And the first thing that came out of our mouths was, they're replacing us already. So growing up with that, you know, it's a lot. And those are things that one of the things that really helped me writing the book was to kind of try to understand, you know, why all those things happen and try to come to terms with many of that heartbreak. But it definitely impacts families and it creates, you know, it creates a very strange dynamic within the family. And once we were reunited, it was very difficult for us to pick up the pieces and put the family back together because things had changed and I hadn't seen my father in 8 years. You know, he was a complete stranger to me when I first met him. And we had grown up and he also struggled to connect the 10-year-old with the 2-year-old he had left behind. And then, so there were, you know, some complications there of me. I had spent 8 years idolizing my parents and they had become bigger than life and I had put them up on a pedestal. And then once I was reunited with them, they turned out to be human beings with other flaws. And so that was very difficult for us.
Now, as you watch the battle over immigration unfolding in this country in the courts with President Obama's immigration law, and you just told us your story, what you went through and how you're still kind of working it out as a writer, what do you wish lawmakers and some of the general public knew about what the experience of immigration is like for families and what's at stake?
Yeah, well, I mean, I would really like for everyone to acknowledge our humanity. You know, a lot of times I feel that the discussion about immigrants leaves out the fact that we're human beings and we're talked about in terms of numbers and statistics. And really just remembering, you know, that we're human beings and also keeping in mind, you know, that there were so many things that went into the decision to immigrate that, like I said earlier, you know, a lot of times it is is an act of survival, and people are willing to risk their lives, and there's a reason why they're willing to risk their lives to come here. So just to remember that, and to be able to talk about immigrants in a more compassionate way, and to be understanding of who we are, and also, you know, to keep in mind that our actions or inactions, you know, especially right now that we haven't had immigration reform, that we are keeping people from being able to reach their dreams and to be able to live their lives. And we're basically forcing people to put their lives on hold and to remain in the shadows and to live in fear, and to not be able to look towards the future with hope, because we're keeping them from that by not giving them the opportunities that they need to get ahead. And especially, you know, I want to speak for our immigrant youth, especially because they are the future of this country, whether we want to accept it or not. And we need to be able to give them those opportunities that they need so that they can reach their full potential, and so that they can use their talents and their passions and their skills to contribute and to give back to this society.
You mentioned dreams. I have to ask, did you ever get that brick house that your father wanted to build?
We did get the brick house, and by the time it got built, there was no one left to live there. Mm. So that was one of the biggest ironies for me, you know, that it took my parents 8 years to build it, and we never lived there because things never got better in Mexico, and that's why we ended up coming here. But I am very grateful, you know, for my father to take that initiative to leave, because he's the reason why I ended up, you know, becoming the first in my family to graduate from college. Now I have an MFA, and my parents didn't even finish elementary school. And now I'm a published writer, and I've been able to pursue my dreams and to develop my skills and my talent so that I can become a contributing member of this society. And then I'm still able to give back everything that I can give back.
You're speaking tonight at, is it 5:30?
Yes, at 5:30 tonight I'm speaking at Centro Hispano. And this is a fundraiser event for Centro Hispano, which is an organization that helps the immigrant community.
Reina, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
That was Reina Grande, award-winning author. Her latest book is called The Distance Between Us.
The event tonight is being recorded. It'll air on Wisconsin Public Television's University Place. Coming up after the news, we talk about honor in America and how it impacts everything from politics to sports to our daily lives. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. This is Central Time.
You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. Coming up, our guest says people are losing patience with the idea of extreme budgeting and maybe looking toward economic change instead.
First, how many times have you heard the line, reputation is everything? Well, our next guest studies that attitude. He says it's just one part of the core of a culture of honor. And he says the idea of honor has played a huge role here in the United States, and often it's been for the worse.
In his most recent book called Honor Bound, How a Cultural Ideal Has Shaped the American Psyche, Ryan Brown talks about how defending and maintaining reputation impacts decisions big and small in the U.S., from public policy to unsportsmanlike conduct.
Ryan Brown joins us now. He's a professor of social psychology at the University of Oklahoma. Ryan, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Hi, Rob. Thanks for having me on. It's great to be with you.
Well, Ryan, I think when a lot of us hear the word honor, we have sort of a vague idea. We have a concept of what it means, probably a good concept, actually. But can you pin it down a little bit for us? What are we talking about when we talk about honor and a culture of honor?
Yeah, so when most people hear the word honor, I think they probably think of things like virtue or excellence or maybe duty or respect. And those are all totally legitimate meanings of this word honor, but they're not primarily what social scientists mean when we talk about honor ideology or a culture of honor. For a social scientist, a culture of honor is a society that puts a special emphasis, some would say an excessive emphasis, on the defense of reputation, and it organizes most of people's lives around this singular priority. So a culture of honor tells men, for example, that they're supposed to be brave and strong and completely intolerant of disrespect. And it tells women that they're supposed to be sexually chaste and to be loyal to their husbands and their families. And living up to these gender-specific expectations is really what it means to obtain honor in an honor culture.
So the word honor might often be in the sentence, you have offended my honor, and it might precede violence.
Exactly. So a man in an honor culture can't tolerate disrespect. When he feels disrespected, and he's very vigilant to any sign of disrespect from others, so when he feels his honor has been threatened, he's been disrespected, he is expected by members of his culture to defend his honor, to defend his reputation. And that expectation extends to engaging in acts of aggression and violence in order to do so, if that seems called for.
Now, this calls to mind, you know, a medieval knight, or maybe reading the Three Musketeers and those offenses to honor leading to duels. Trace it into the United States for us. You say it comes in large part originally from Scotland.
It does in the United States, at least among Caucasians. So the Scots, especially the southern Scots, developed a fairly typical honor culture over a period of more than 1,000 years, being constantly invaded from the south by the English or raided from the north by the Highlanders, and not having a very strong central government, a strong king that was able to keep the peace and to defend its citizens from external threats or from internal threats. So those people developed an honor culture as a way of sort of filling this social vacuum. Honor cultures seem to develop in places around the world where people don't have a lot of resources, they feel economically vulnerable, but also where there's not a strong rule of law. So in those sort of circumstances, when no one's coming to your aid to defend you in case you're under attack, or someone insults you or physically aggresses against you, you have to be known as a person who won't tolerate that kind of behavior. You have to have a reputation as being someone who's intolerant of disrespect, intolerant of abuse or exploitation. And you build up that sort of reputation by small acts of aggression, of sort of microaggressions all the way up to being willing to call someone out and engage in a duel if that's what your particular culture does. So the Southern Scots had that kind of an honor culture. They then imported that to the United States in the 1700s and early 1800s when they came over in really large waves of immigration, settling in the Appalachians primarily, and then from there down into the Deep South and into the West. So when you think about the feuding families, the Hatfields and the McCoys, those were descendants of Scottish immigrants influenced by the Scottish culture of honor. Now, Hispanic culture is also an example of a fairly typical honor culture, and so there are parts of the United States where you'll see a different strain of an honor culture, but in many respects it's very similar to this Scottish imported honor culture.
Talking to Ryan Brown, his new book is Honor Bound, How a Cultural Ideal Has Shaped the American Psyche. And yeah, you trace a little bit about the modern geography of honor culture. I note that we here in Wisconsin are really low, I think 48th among the states, more so concentrated in, as you're mentioning, the South and the West.
Yeah, so social scientists who study the dynamics of honor culture ideology in the United States talk about honor states and dignity states. So honor states are primarily states in the South and in the West. Dignity states are states more in the North, Northeast, and Northern Midwest, like Wisconsin. The reason for the difference in the name, the honor states versus dignity states, is that in honor states, we believe that the right to be treated with respect has to be earned. And like anything that can be earned, that right can be taken away. You can lose that by acts of dishonor or allowing someone to dishonor you, disrespect you. In a dignity state or a dignity culture, people tend to assume explicitly or implicitly that you have a right to be treated with respect simply because you're a human being. So that's not something that can be taken away from you because you don't stop being a human being. So you have a sort of basic level of intrinsic dignity or worth or value. And you don't have to earn it. Can't be taken away. These are two different approaches to the idea of human value or human worth. And in honor cultures around the world, honor states in the U.S. and the South and West, this sort of mentality tends to prevail. although it's important to note that not everybody living in an honor state is especially honor-oriented, and not everyone living in a dignity state rejects the ideology of honor. There are lots of subcultures of honor. An inner-city gang, for example, has a fairly typical honor culture most of the time. So do a lot of police or military units. They have honor-oriented subcultures.
Right, so this might sound a little bit like, oh, it's just a curious nuance of social science, but let's take it a little further. You write that honor culture, this idea of honor, leads to a lot of bad things, including, I don't know where to start in some ways, let's say domestic violence. The idea of honor informs a lot of acts, horrific acts of domestic violence. Can you connect those for us?
Yeah, that's correct. Now, and to be clear, not everything about honor cultures is bad, but there is a lot of bad stuff that is associated empirically with people who endorse this cultural ideology of honor. So we've known for a long time that a major factor in homicides in general is people feeling disrespected. And so one person issues a challenge or disrespects someone, the other person responds in kind and ups the ante, and so forth, until eventually they have to go out in the parking lot and handle it like men, so to speak. That's sort of the honor formula, and somebody may end up dead at the end of the altercation. The same is also true of domestic homicide. When men feel profoundly disrespected by their wives, especially if they feel like their wife might be cheating on them, this is a common precursor to domestic violence and domestic homicide at the extreme end. So honor-oriented people magnify those sort of dynamics, and as a result, we see higher rates of domestic homicide, particularly the death of spouses, in honor-oriented states among Caucasians. So again, if you're gonna look at differences in honor states versus dignity states in the U.S., you really have to constrain yourself to looking at Caucasians or European Americans, because that's the demographic group among whom these honor-oriented values tend to be regionally distributed, the way that we distinguish between honor states and dignity states. So that's a pretty dark manifestation of the dynamics of honor, this word that sounds so positive, and it is in a few respects, but in so many ways it's not. Another way that we see the dark side of honor-related dynamics is in suicide. I mentioned earlier that this belief that you have to earn the right to be respected, and anything that you have to earn can be taken away from you or lost, applies to people who have failed to live up to the standards of honor in their honor culture. If you feel profoundly dishonored, if your reputation has been damaged to a certain point where you don't feel like you can get it back, you might feel that the only way to really maybe not regain your honor, but at least escape from dishonor, is to commit suicide. And as a consequence of that, we actually see higher rates of suicide, again, among Caucasians living in honor states compared to dignity states. And this difference, just like the difference we see with homicide, is especially strong among Caucasians living in small towns in honor states. Because in a small town, everybody knows who you are. Everybody knows your successes, your glories, and things that bring you respect. But everybody also knows when you failed and when you've been shamed and disrespected. And so these sorts of reputational concerns are magnified in non-metropolitan areas.
We're talking to Ryan Brown. He's a professor of social psychology at the University of Oklahoma, and his most recent book is called Honor Bound: How a Cultural Ideal Has Shaped the American Psyche.
And we want to hear from you. Did you have heroes growing up that were supposed to teach you about honor? Do you think it had a positive or a negative impact on your life? You can call us at 800-642-1234 or post on the Central Time Facebook page. Are you a parent? Do you still believe in teaching your kids about honor? Were you raised to keep things like honor in mind? And tell us how you may have seen honor play out, ideas about honor, how that comes into play in your community. Call us at 800-642-1234.
We'll pick up the conversation, maybe hear from you in just a few moments here on Central Time.
You're listening to Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickard.
And I'm Rob Ferret. We're picking up our conversation now with Ryan Brown. He's professor of social psychology at the University of Oklahoma. He's the author of the book about the idea of honor. It's called Honor Bound: How a Cultural Ideal Has Shaped the American Psyche.
And we'd love to get your take on this. What do you think about this idea of honor and defending our honor, for better or for worse? Do you see your own community or your family as embodying some of this honor culture that we're talking about? You can call us at 800-642-1234 or post on the Central Time Facebook page. When you're making a business decision or personal decisions, do you consider things like name or reputation? Call 800-642-1234.
Ryan, let's talk about how we might be able to use this concept of honor maybe to treat, maybe to prevent a horrible act. When we look at something like a street violence or domestic abuse, from the outside, we look at it rightly as a horrible act, and we think of it maybe as being done by a malevolent person. Inside, from what you're saying, it sounds like they're thinking, I'm doing a virtuous thing. I have to protect my honor by doing this violent behavior, no matter how other people might judge me afterward.
Well, that's right. And I think in a lot of cases, when we view abhorrent violent acts, we tend to go to explanations that revolve around psychopathology. And certainly there are sadistic people, psychopaths out there, but most violent acts are committed by people who are not psychotic, who are not psychopaths. They're committed by people who are mentally healthy, but who are culturally programmed to be sort of hypervigilant to any potential threat to their honor, and who are culturally programmed to respond to any perceived threat with fairly extreme acts of aggression, which can include homicide. So I think it is important when we encounter horrific acts to not quite as quickly as we're used to doing go to explanations that revolve around psychopathology.
Let's bring on our callers now at 800-642-1234. Richard joins us in Eau Claire. Richard, hi.
Hello, and thanks for taking the call. Yeah, and I certainly think that honor is honorable. And I have been taught that. I'm 74 years old and all my life, and I also would teach that and encourage that, and I have encouraged it with my children, who are all adults and doing very well. I would encourage it to for them and myself and us to teach that and promote honor with our children. And I think to find a dark side of honor is typical of what's going on in our education system today. I think honor goes along with integrity, honesty. All those good things are honorable.
And Richard, I want to pin you down on defining honor, because it's a pretty broad concept. Do you mean like maybe even using?
Anybody
go ahead.
That commits suicide, you blame it on them losing honor. They've lost something long time other than that, and that's called morality. I'll hang up and see what your comments are.
Richard, thanks for the call. And Ryan, you write that you've gotten similar responses to Richard's over the years. Do you think there's a disagreement, or is it that our definition of honor that we might be using functionally in our daily lives is maybe a little different than what you're tackling?
Yeah, I appreciate the caller's comments. I don't disagree with them necessarily. I think it really is a matter of using terms consistently. And again, what I mean when I say honor ideology is probably a little different from what the caller meant. So he used the term integrity. Well, who doesn't want their kids to have integrity? Honesty, trustworthiness, loyalty. These are all wonderful qualities that, of course, we want to instill in our children. We want to demonstrate them as parents and their ideals to live up to. The problem is that honor-oriented cultures, which, again, are focused on reputation management, reputation defense, they don't actually tend to promote a lot of these honorable qualities, right, where we're going to use that word synonymously with integrity or with honesty. They really don't tend to promote those qualities, not in the way that we assume that they do by using the word honor in kind of this more everyday sense. So as a social scientist, what I mean when I say honor ideology really is different than I think what the caller was meaning when he was using that term.
Richard, thanks for that call. And you write that this honor ideology can conflict with religious beliefs. A religion, say it, Christianity, that says turn the other cheek as one of its tenets conflicts with something that says don't back down from an insult, don't back down from a fight.
Well, that's right. And we've done a number of investigations looking at the connection between honor ideology and religious ideology, and we find very little association between the two. There's, of course, different ways of being religious. You could just be sort of socially identified as a religious person. Yeah, I go to church once a year, or I attend a mosque once a year, or a synagogue, or whatever, sort of in a shallow social identification way. You can also be deeply religious. Your religious beliefs can be an end in themselves, or they can be a means to an end. So social scientists over the last several decades have developed a number of different tools for examining the different ways in which people may express their religious beliefs. And so we've attempted to measure some of those different ways within a sample of people from the United States, and we find almost no association at all between religiosity and honor ideology. And it turns out that similar conclusions have come out of the Middle East, where you think, oh, these are practically the same thing. But kids growing up in extremely religious Islamic homes are not actually much more honor-oriented than kids growing up in non-religious Islamic homes or in completely non-Islamic homes, but still in the Middle East. So these are really different ideological belief systems, and at times, as in the example that you gave about turn the other cheek, they're completely at odds with one another. In a way, you can think of these as ideological systems that both demand preeminence in a person's life, and you simply cannot serve two ideological masters. Not all the time, anyway. And so religion and honor are actually very different animals.
Talking to Ryan Brown, his new book is called Honor Bound, How a Cultural Ideal Has Shaped the American Psyche. Back to our callers now with Ben in Stoughton. Ben, hi.
Hello. I just want to make a distinction. It has to do with using the words differently and vocabulary. But for me, honor is acting in a way that's consistent with your values, especially when it's difficult to do that. And for me, pride is the place of concern that I think the guest is talking about, where we, in a hyper-defensiveness, defending your pride, concern with yourself, that can lead to violence. But I think honor is something a little different, at least the way I use the word most often.
Ben, thanks a lot for that call. And Ryan, getting into that usage of honor again, but it sounds like Ben is using pride in the way that you and other social scientists are talking about honor culture in a way.
Yeah, I think that's a good connection. And of course, the word pride can mean good things as well as bad things. Mm-hmm. We want our children to have pride in themselves, in their families, in their cultural heritages, for example. So in that sense, pride is a really good thing that we want kids to have. There's also a version of pride that we don't necessarily want our children to have, and that is more of what I'm talking about when I talk about honor-oriented cultures. It is a very, it's a proud sort of system. It's one that says my reputation must be defended at all costs, no matter what. And that can extend, by the way, to your family, especially if you are in a very family-oriented, a more collectivistic culture. There are collectivistic honor cultures and more individualistic honor cultures like the United States. And it can also extend to your community or even to your nation. So honor-oriented people who feel a threat to their nation's honor or reputation, they tend to endorse fairly extreme international policies that say anybody that threatens our nation's reputation, we have to attack them. We have to defend ourselves. We have to even preempt potential attacks. In one study that we did several years ago, we asked people to just imagine that the Statue of Liberty had been attacked and its head had been blown off by terrorists. And respondents who thought about that, who were especially high in honor ideology, who really endorsed this cultural ideology of honor, they were willing to have the United States attack the people responsible with nuclear and chemical weapons. So this is a very extreme response, I would say, to the nation's honor. Obviously, it's not just reputation that's at stake when terrorists attack, but they weren't feeling personally threatened, right? So their personal sense of honor had extended much more broadly to their community and to the nation.
That's a good place to leave it. Thanks to Ryan Brown, professor of social psychology at the University of Oklahoma. We've been talking about his book on the concept of honor. It's called Honor Bound, How a Cultural Ideal Has Shaped the American Psyche. You can still share your thoughts. Just head over to the Central Time Facebook page.
Well, we got pretty excited today when we noticed that it turns out today is Cow Appreciation Day. Mm-hmm. I mean, I would say that we appreciate cows every day in Wisconsin, certainly when we're eating delicious cheese. But the idea of an extra day set aside just to appreciate cows, it's pretty enticing.
Well, you did a little more digging, Veronica, and it turns out Cow Appreciation Day is really just the marketing campaign for the chicken franchise Chick-fil-A, who are giving free food to people who show up dressed as, yes, a cow in their restaurants today.
Right, that's true. But put all that aside, and Twitter is still kind of fun on Cow Appreciation Day today. Mm-hmm. You've got kids dressed up as cows on Twitter, cow videos, cows with beautiful flowing wigs with the breeze flowing through their hair, and plugs, of course, for ice cream and stuff like that. So the question is, Rob, how will we celebrate Cow Appreciation Day?
Well, as you know, and this is radio, so you can't see that listening now, but Veronica and Michelle know I come dressed as a cow every day here on Central Time. So Cow Appreciation Day is nothing different for me. It gets warm, I'm not going to lie to you, on a hot, humid July day. Veronica?
I'm wearing black and white today, and I'm thankful that no one commented on my cow costume. But
it's I have never seen a cow with that pattern.
Right.
So, it did not occur to me.
You haven't seen a lot of cows. You only wear the one costume every day.
Right, and it doesn't have eye holes, so
point.
I don't see a lot. I just hit my head on the microphone again. Well, moo from all of us here on Central Time. We'll be back in just a few after the news.